An update to a federal rule to protect people from lead in drinking water has been delayed again. There's a lot of debate about the most effective way to protect public health.
Most of the lead in people's drinking water isn't coming from lead service pipes. It's coming from the plumbing in their house.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the back and forth over the lead and copper rule. Plus, how much power should the federal government have to create public lands?
When we hear people saying that the president can't protect these large landscapes, that's just simply wrong.
And one of the hottest years on record could be good for crops, but bad for our lungs.
As it gets hotter, we expect the air pollution levels to go up.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Lead levels in Pittsburgh's drinking water are again above the Environmental Protection Agency's action level of 15 parts per billion. The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority announced recently that the latest round of compliance testing showed levels at 21 parts per billion. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed has more.
Compliance testing is only to be done at sites known to have lead service lines or lead solder. PWSA Interim Executive Director Bob Weimer said earlier this month he anticipated higher lead levels this round because ineligible sites had been purged from the program.
We're trying to be more transparent. We're going beyond, I think, what others do to ensure that there's no question about the purpose and intent and result of our program.
Weimer says PWSA has asked the state for permission to switch to orthophosphates for corrosion control. He says that will bring lead levels down below 5 parts per billion. Last summer, the authority was just at the Environmental Protection Agency's action level of 15 parts per billion. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
The problem of lead in our drinking water has been in the public consciousness for years. But since the tragedy with Flint, Michigan's water, which poisoned hundreds of children, and reports of lead in water in cities like Pittsburgh, there's more awareness about overhauling federal regulation of lead in water. The Allegheny Friend's Julie Grant reports that many experts are concerned EPA is considering changes that could actually weaken protections for public health.
The intention of the lead rule is to protect public health. To find out how well it works, we asked Mark Edwards, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech. He helped expose Flint's lead problem.
To understand what a sick joke the existing law has become, you only need to know that as National Guard walked the streets of Flint, Michigan, distributing bottled water and filters, and we had neighborhoods of children with elevated lead in their blood, Flint was not failing the lead and copper rule.
How could this happen? How could a community with such high lead levels in the water not have been violating the regulation meant to prevent lead in the water? Well, under the current rule, water utilities are supposed to test tap water at some of the homes it considers high risk for lead every few years. If 10% or more taps sampled have high concentrations, the utility is supposed to take action. That could mean adjusting corrosion control chemicals at the water treatment plant or starting a program to replace water service lines made of lead. But that's expensive. Edwards says many utilities like Flint use testing methods that cheat the rule.
We've known about horrific gaps in loopholes in this rule for at least 10 years now.
The Guardian newspaper last year identified 33 cities that use those loopholes. Pittsburgh was not listed, but those that were, Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia, do things like instruct people to pre-flush the tap or remove aerators from the faucet before testing the water. These techniques can hide lead contamination. Philadelphia declined to comment for this story. A class action lawsuit on behalf of residents alleges that city of cheating. And in Flint?
We are announcing charges against 4 individuals.
The state filed criminal charges against local and state officials, in part for hiding the lead levels from residents. But even before the crisis in Flint, Tom Neltner was on a committee tasked with overhauling the 26-year-old lead in water rule.
EPA has a National Drinking Water Advisory Committee, and they formed a work group called the Lead and Copper Rule Work Group.
Neltner is Chemicals Policy Director at the Environmental Defense Fund. The committee also included about 20 water utilities and public health departments. In 2015, they came out with a set of recommendations. Their focus was on replacing lead service lines. Those are the pipes that connect the main water line that runs along your street into your home.
Well, we basically said that the current system makes lead service line the last resort. You only do it after corrosion control has failed and nothing else is working. What we said is you need to start now. That right up front, you need to have a program to get these lines replaced.
The American Water Works Association, which represents the industry, has endorsed this recommendation. Most older cities are rife with lead service lines. Replacing them throughout the country could take 30 years or more. Pittsburgh has already been ordered to replace 7% of its lead service lines a year because of its elevated lead levels and problems with corrosion control. Some experts say this still won't solve the problem in many homes.
Well, that won't do very much because most of the lead in people's drinking water isn't coming from lead service pipes. It's coming from the plumbing in their house.
Joel Schwartz is an environmental epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health. He says many homes, even if they don't have lead service lines, still have lead in the solder that connects the pipes and valves and faucets. Schwartz wants the revised lead and copper rule to focus instead on improving corrosion control chemistry.
Corrosion control helps everywhere and is a lot cheaper.
Yana Lambrinidou is a professor of science and technology and society at Virginia Tech, and she was a member of the EPA working group to update the lead and copper rule. Well, she supports replacing lead lines.
I think that is a no-brainer.
She also wrote an extensive dissent because the recommendations wouldn't close the loopholes that allow utilities to underestimate lead in the water. In fact, they wouldn't even require sampling in homes at highest risk for lead anymore, which she says might make things worse. Those home lead samples inform the corrosion control decisions that are supposed to keep lead levels low.
When in reality, the lead action level is not met, the water is not safe to drink, and the corrosion control treatment in place is not adequate to protect people from serious exposures.
The EPA is expected to use the working group recommendations to write and release an official draft rule later this year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
EPA was supposed to come out with a draft rule in 2017, but that's been delayed until this August. That means finalizing the changes wouldn't happen until February 2020. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Million acres of public land in Utah will no longer be protected as national monuments, and many people are angry about it.
The injustice of undoing the monument represents atrocity, injustice, and pain that the Native Americans have endured.
Later on the Allegheny Front, the Trump administration's legal battle over shrinking public lands. Stay tuned. Researchers at Duke University have found waste from conventional oil and gas drilling is causing a spike in radioactivity in three Pennsylvania waterways. The Allegheny Front's energy reporter Reed Fraser is here with more about their study. Hey, Reed.
Hey, Kara.
So where was this radioactive material found and how did it get there?
Okay, so the material was found in the sediment of three locations, one on the Allegheny River, and two others in creeks that drain into the Allegheny River. And these were all found immediately downstream of industrial wastewater treatment plants. How it got there is kind of that's the sort of big question the researchers from Duke were trying to answer. And they concluded that it got into the stream from conventional oil and gas waste. You know, when we think of drilling in Pennsylvania, we think of the Marcellus Shale, and we think of fracking. This waste is kind of the wastewater that came out of traditional oil and gas wells that had been in Pennsylvania for the last 150 years. There is still a conventional oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania. It's a lot smaller than the Marcellus Shale industry, and it still produces wastewater.
So the radiation is from wastewater being treated at these plants. What's in the wastewater that makes it radioactive?
When they drill these wells, they bring up gas and sometimes oil, and they bring up some of this water that had been in the rocks for, you know, millions of years, basically. And when it's in the rocks, it picks up all these contaminants. They're basically naturally occurring elements and minerals that are just in the ground from when the gas was formed. And the radioactive part of this is this element called radium. And there's a couple of variants of radium or isotopes that have, you know, radioactive characteristics. And so that's where this radioactive material is coming from.
Well, how high are the radium levels in these places that they studied? And is it dangerous for people or for wildlife?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So they basically found that the radium levels in these sediments downstream of these plants were 650 times greater than just upstream of the plants.
Whoa.
In some places, it was basically the same level of radioactivity as, say, low-level radioactive waste. Now, what is the danger of having this, you know, pretty radioactive stuff at the bottom of the stream? Nothing imminent. As long as you don't, like, eat the stream sediment, you know, you're not going to get exposed to this. However, you know, there's a danger that as this stuff decays and decomposes, it could get picked up into the food chain and eventually find its way into fish. And so if you end up eating the fish from these streams, you too could get exposed to radium, which is not good for you. I mean, it is linked to cancers and other diseases.
Is this water not used for people's drinking water sources? Or if it is it filtered out somehow?
Yeah, that's a very good question. All of these streams are tributaries of the Allegheny River, and the Allegheny River is the source of drinking water for many places along it, including the city of Pittsburgh. So by the time it gets to Pittsburgh, the radiation has been diluted. However, just in case, radium is something that drinking water plants have to, you know, measure and make sure that they're not exceeding.
You know, since 2011, fracking wastewater from unconventional drilling hasn't been treated at treatment plants. It hasn't been allowed. What are the regulations around wastewater from these conventional oil and gas drillers? Is this part of their normal operation?
Yeah. They're allowed to release a certain amount of, you know, for lack of a better word, pollution into the streams. And I think it's important to go back to that 2011 time period when the Marcellus shale industry first came to Pennsylvania. They started producing a lot more wastewater than the conventional industry had, you know, on a per well basis. It can be 10 to 20 to 30 times more wastewater. So what ended up happening was this stuff was just kind of getting treated not very well and put into rivers and streams, and it was actually changing the chemistry of places like the Monongahela River. So the state ended up stepping in, putting in some new restrictions on the discharge limits that these treatment plants could use. And they also said, you know, if you have Marcellus shale wastewater, you have to take it somewhere special where it does a better job of cleaning up the water. So in a nutshell, I mean, the conventional drilling waste has that sort of older standard. You know, there are standards for things like total suspended solids, the amount of oil and grease, acidity and pH and things like that, that it can discharge into the waters. But it doesn't have the same stringent controls that, you know, say Marcellus shale waste has on it.
Did the researchers say how long these radioactive materials have been accumulating there? Is it like a couple of years? Is it, you know, decades?
Well, the way they went about their study was actually kind of interesting. They wanted to see, you know, they had detected radioactive material in these streams before. They'd been studying them for many years. I actually was at one of these test sites many years ago on a story I did with some of the researchers from a previous effort. But they had a technique where they would look at the waste. And of course, if this is a radioactive stuff, so it decays. and they could measure how old the radium was by how much it had decayed. And what they figured was that a certain amount of it was still accumulating in the river after 2011, when the state asked drilling companies, and drilling companies complied, to not send their wastewater to these plants. So their conclusion was that this is not some leftover vestige of the Marcellus Shale industry's wastewater. This is current wastewater that's coming from conventional wells.
What does the regulator, the State Department of Environmental Protection, say about this study?
When I got in touch with them, they said they were reviewing the findings, and they didn't have really a comment about it. So they're kind of taking it all in.
Okay. Well, we'll maybe follow back up with you when they've had a chance to look at it.
Sounds good. Thanks, okay. Kara.
All right. Thanks, Reed. Reed Fraser covers energy for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. There's more of his reporting on this study at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. President Trump pledged to boost American manufacturing. Recently, he took a step he says will move the country closer to that goal. Trump imposed a 30% tariff on imported solar panels. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports for State Impact Pennsylvania about what this means for the state solar industry.
This decision pits solar manufacturers against installers. U.S. manufacturers found it tough to compete against subsidized solar panels from China. They wanted a tariff to level the playing field. Some solar installers fear this new tariff will lead to a price spike and a drop in installations. For someone wanting to install solar panels on their roof, Bloomberg estimates the tariff will lead to a 3% price increase. Ron Celentano is with the Pennsylvania Solar Energy Industries Association.
So we're certainly going to be affected by this now in the state, but I don't think it will be a showstopper. It's not going to just slam the door shut.
He anticipates the tariff may hurt big utility-scale solar farms that operate on tight margins. But Pennsylvania has mostly small rooftop and commercial solar projects, with customers motivated by a desire for clean energy and willing to pay more to get it. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Globally, last year was the second hottest on record, according to NASA. It's a continuation of the rapid warming trend of the last 40 years. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant looks at how Pennsylvania is faring.
NASA reports that 2017's globally averaged temperatures were second only to 2016. Although Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and other parts of the state didn't see that kind of temperature rise, Kyle Imhoff is the state climatologist based at Penn State University.
Pennsylvania was actually, it was the seventh warmest year on record, so not quite as warm as if you looked globally, but yeah, still a warm year any way you look at it.
Imhoff says Pennsylvania has seen a 1 to 2 degree Fahrenheit rise in temperature in the last 100 to 150 years, but it's not happening during the day.
We're getting warmer at night, or we're not getting as cold as we used to. Why are we warmer? Nighttime temperatures are not as cold as they used to be.
Imhoff says there are some benefits, like a longer growing season for crops. But in a region like Pittsburgh, where air pollution is already a health issue, rising temperatures could worsen the problem.
Right now, in Allegheny County, there's about 250 deaths per year from air pollution, almost all associated with breathing fine particles. That's a lot, by the way.
That's Neil Donahue, an atmospheric chemist at Carnegie Mellon University.
As it gets hotter, we expect the air pollution levels to go up. The chemistry gets more aggressive. So levels of ozone go up, but levels of fine particles, especially organic fine particles, go up as well.
Donahue says those fine particles can trigger heart attacks, similar to smoking. He says scientists aren't seeing this increase yet because the temperature rise has been relatively small in Pennsylvania so far. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Here's some news, not about warming temperatures and climate change, but about adapting to new climates. A new study shows that invasive plant species easily make themselves at home in new environments and muscle out native species.
There's been this underlying assumption for hundreds of years that climate influences where species occur. And in fact, we found that the majority of plant species actually do change once they are moved to new continents.
Jacob Barney is an associate professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Virginia Tech. He and his colleagues looked at more than 800 plant species. They found that some invasive species don't have to live in the same climate and conditions as where they came from. So if a plant occurs in cool, wet places in Europe, it's not more likely to occur in cool, wet places in the United States.
And this has a sort of a fundamental change in how we viewed plant species that has been under study since Darwin sailed on the Beagle.
Barney says not all species behave the same way. Long-lived woody plants are more likely to do well in different climates than annual plants. And people play a role, too. The plants we cultivate in our gardens, the ones from local nurseries and big box stores, they have an advantage in new climates. But knowledge is power.
One of the things that we've learned over time is that once an invasive plant establishes, it is really difficult to remove. So now we have a better capability of understanding where they might move in the future so we can prevent that.
There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Late last year, President Trump approved the largest rollback of federal land protection in our country's history.
I called all of the friends that I have in Utah. I said, what do you think? I said, will this be good for our country? And will it be good for your state?
He drastically slashed the size of two national monuments in Utah, Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. It wasn't a surprise, but it was controversial. When President Obama designated Bear's Ears at the end of his presidency, many in Utah, including ranchers, balked at what they saw as federal overreach. Some Native Americans were gratified that what they see as sacred land was being protected. But now they're ready for a fight.
The valuable landscape absolutely means a lot to each of the tribes. The injustice of undoing the monument represents atrocity, injustice, and pain that the Native Americans have endured.
We have prepared litigation in order to challenge President Trump's actions.
We are committed to defending the Bear's Ears National Monument.
We are committed to defending the Bear's Ears National Monument.
That's from a Facebook video produced by the Bear's Ears Intertribal Coalition. Trump's decision has touched off a new legal debate.
When we hear people saying that the president can't protect these large landscapes, that's just simply wrong.
John Ruppel is an associate professor of law at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah. He says the Antiquities Act has allowed presidents to create monuments the smallest size they feel is necessary to protect natural and historical resources, like archaeological sites. Teddy Roosevelt designated the Grand Canyon as a monument. It was later expanded and, of course, became a national park. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant talked with Ruppel about whether a president has the authority to undo or change monuments created by past presidents.
There are a number of lawsuits challenging President Trump's decision to shrink these monuments. You are part of a group called Friends of Cedar Mesa, one of the groups that is suing President Trump over his decision. So what is the legal basis for the lawsuit that you're a part of? Who else and what other groups have you joined there?
Well, there are five lawsuits pending, three challenging the decision to reduce Bear's Ears National Monument and two challenging the reduction of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Now, the heart of the argument here is whether the president has the power to rescind and replace a national monument. And President Trump's actions are unprecedented, and there's a strong legal case against them. The Constitution grants Congress exclusive authority over public lands, and 121 law professors from around the country wrote the administration earlier this year to reiterate that the Antiquities Act empowers the president to create national monuments, but not to undo them. Had Congress intended to grant the president that power, they could have done so explicitly, as they have done on other conservation-oriented laws. Congress has tried to enact legislation giving the president broad authority to reduce or revise national monuments. That legislation has consistently failed. So the only real plausible argument for the president's authority to slash monuments comes from prior reductions, because presidents have indeed reduced national monuments in the past. But when we start looking at that, we see that, you know, that doesn't provide a whole lot of authority. First, it's been 54 years since a president last shrank a national monument. That was President Kennedy. It involved a Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico. The Atomic Energy Commission had released some lands out of the Los Alamos National Lab, and the president said, I'm going to revise the boundary to make this work much better. So since then, Congress has enacted legislation that has reined in the president's authority in this area, where Congress has explicitly said, we want to have more control. And we've never seen this kind of large-scale, million-plus-acre reduction that's been done for what appear to be naked political reasons.
I know you don't have a crystal ball here, but with all the lawsuits that have come up since President Trump's decision to reduce the size of these two monuments, what do you think, what's going to happen next, and what do you think the outcome of all this may be?
Well, we have five lawsuits ongoing. We know that there are more national monuments that are under review and likely to be, you know, reduced or revised, and that will lead to even more litigation. I think the case against these reductions is very strong, but in the end, litigation is a blunt tool. It can be very divisive, and what we really need are residents to come together and figure out these hard balancing questions about how do we manage public lands, how do we accommodate, you know, these range of uses in a way that's sensitive to the really special nature of these lands.
John Ruppel is Associate Professor of Law at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah. He's also on the board of a group that's suing President Trump over his revisions to Bears Ears. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for our podcast, Trump on Earth. Since that conversation, nine members of a board which advises the Department of the Interior on how to manage national parks have resigned. They say Secretary Ryan Zinke ignored their request to meet with them and that he had no interest in their bipartisan expertise in science and conservation that could help him and the department make decisions about public lands. You can hear more of this conversation about national monuments at TrumpOnEarth.org, or you can find Trump on Earth wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on our show, The Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.